Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
That war rocket Ajax to bring back his body.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts. My name is Chris Sims, and with me, as always, is my co-host, the Waluigi to my Wario, Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, how are you today?
That's my Waluigi laugh.
That's him. That is what he does. You got it.
That's how I'm doing. I'm loopy enough that I'll just answer a question with a Waluigi laugh.
Like, are you running on low sleep? Because I'm running on low sleep, buddy. I'm running on 5 hours.
I'm on some fumes, but I'm doing well, and I'm excited about our episode this week. I'm excited about our guest. I'm excited about what we're going to talk to him about. James D'Amato is returning to War Rocket Ajax once again to talk about his Kickstarter for Dungeon Dome, which pushes all of our collective buttons, Chris, because it's a combination of tabletop gaming and pro wrestling, which is right up our alley.
That's right, Matt. I am excited to talk to James. He is always one of our favorite people, and we're really going to get into it and find out about why he is doing what's basically a wrestling-based project when he is a guy who is not... He's not in the Skip the Show segment of the population. But he's definitely not the wrestling fan that you might expect this to come from. So he is going to be a great guest, as usual.
Before we talk to James, Chris, let's take care of some business. Starting with thanking our newest Patreon supporter.
These are the people who have gone over to patreon.com/warrocketajax, and they're kicking in as little as a dollar every month to help us keep the lights on and pay those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills. Matt, who do we have to thank this week?
Just one name to add to the pile this week. Zach.
Oh, well, thank you, Zach.
If you would like to do what Zach did and help us out here on War Rocket Ajax with as little as $1 a month, you can head on over to patreon.com/warrocketajax and get cool stuff like ad-free episodes of the show, bonus audio, exclusive patron art that only patrons get, physical rewards, and more. So head over to patreon.com/warrocketajax and kick it a little bit if you can. All right, Chris, with that, let's do some checks and wrecks. Chris, what are you checking in with this week?
What do you know about Alexander the Great?
Well, I know that he was a conqueror, and he was from Macedonia.
Did you know that when he looked upon the breadth of his empire, he wept, for there were no more worlds to conquer?
I've been made aware of that, yes.
See, I felt like that when I ran out of episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation to watch on Netflix.
Yes, there was no Rikers left to conquer.
So, instead, the other day I decided, let's do this, let's jump in, let's see how committed I am to this. And I started watching Enterprise. Enterprise, the prequel show, starring Count Bakula as Jonathan Archer, the captain of the NX-01, Starfleet's first deep space exploration craft. Matt, that show's weird from fucking Jump Street. I'm in the first season, and I have heard, I was on Retronauts. We recorded an episode just a couple days ago, and I was talking to Jeremy Parrish and Benj about it. And they said that by the time it hits, like, season 3, season 4, that it's honestly some of the best Star Trek stuff around. And I hate hearing that, because that means I'm gonna fucking watch it all just to get there. I did it with Power Rangers. I'm gonna do it with Star Trek Enterprise. But these first episodes, for one thing, they do a lot of the, oh, this ship can go at warp 4.5. It's the fastest ship we've ever seen. And then they do like a, what, you know, oh, you Vulcans, you'll never trust the humans. And then they do the, what's this guy, some kind of Klingar? It's a Klingon, Captain. It's very bad. But it also, Matt, if you were going to, I'm going to describe Star Trek, and you've watched a lot of Rikers in your time.
I've watched my share of Rikers, that is true.
If I was to tell you that Star Trek was weirdly blank, how would you finish that sentence?
Horny.
Yeah, horny. It's so fucking horny. It's, there is canonically, in Star Trek, a planet that is just a 24/7 fuckfest. It's called Risa. Look it up on Memory Alpha. The first episode, the pilot episode of Enterprise, has a scene where the Vulcan lady, T'Pol, and the guy with a southern accent, whose name I do not recall, they're mad at each other, but they have been contaminated by being on an away team, so they gotta strip down and scrub each other while they're having an argument. It's buck wild.
Do you think that was like a network, like the network made them do that? The network made them put a sexy scene in the pilot?
No. No, I don't, because I have watched other Star Trek, and it's like the natural extension of where we get from Next Generation.
That's fair. Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. In terms of costume design, T'Pol is basically 7 of 9. So, yeah. Anyway, I have a lot of difficulty imagining going back and trying to get through Voyager, but goddamn, I might just have to stick it out with Enterprise. So that's what's up with me this week, Matt. What's up with you?
Not this past weekend, but the weekend before, I drove to Lexington, Kentucky, to participate in a signing at Collectibles, etc. And I said last week before it, when we recorded it before it happened, but the episode came out after, that I'm sure it went well, and I can guarantee you that it did. It went great. It was a fun, fun time. I want to say big, big thanks to Jewett, the owner of Collectibles, etc., for being so nice and so welcoming to me while I was there. And I want to say thanks to Benito Serino, our good friend of the show, for letting me hang out in Lexington. I got to go around Lexington. I'd never been to that town before. It's a really cool city, and a lot of stuff there was cool. It was Burger Week. So I got to eat burgers for every meal, because the whole idea of Burger Week is that like 50 different restaurants in town each have the signature burger that they sell for $5. So I tried some of those burgers. I bought some bourbon while I was there because I was in Kentucky, and I just had an overall all good time. And I wanted to verify and validate that happened. Also, Chris, this is not my wreck because you wrecked it last week. But the night before we were recording this episode, I saw Spider-Man Homecoming. It's good, good shit. I think we'll maybe record a spoiler special for some bonus content about it in the near future.
That seems like a very good idea, because I would love to talk to you about that movie.
Everything I want to say about it is a spoiler. So maybe we can do that in the near future. I would like to talk about some spoilery things from that movie. I liked it a lot. I don't know if I'm as up on it as you were, though. So I would like to discuss that. I don't know if I would say it's my favorite Marvel movie. It's certainly my favorite Spider-Man movie, but it's not my favorite Marvel movie necessarily.
What would you put above it?
I still like Winter Soldier a lot. I like the first Guardians movie, even though I know there's been some backlash to it that is not totally unearned. Yeah, I mean, I'd have to sit down with those movies again, I think, to determine which one is my absolute favorite, but it's up there. I just don't know if it's my number one. And one last thing that I will note, another event that's coming up that I'll let you guys know about. I'm going to be participating in the WNC Authors Festival at the Asheville Mall, Barnes & Noble, August 19th from 2 to 4. I'll be one of about a dozen local authors. Hanging out, signing books. I think there might be kind of like a panel thing there. So if you want to come out and meet me there, if you haven't been able to come out to some of my other stuff in or around Asheville, I will be at that author festival hanging out. So mark your calendars for that if you haven't come out to see me previously. And that's it for my checks. Chris, what do you have to recommend?
My recommendation is going to be something that I actually talked about pretty frequently last week, or pretty in-depth last week, I guess I should say. I'm going to recommend the new book by Jennifer Wright, Get Well Soon. I know I mentioned that I picked it up from the library, but I think the only reason that I didn't actually wreck it was that I wasn't that far into it. And now I am. I'm about three quarters of the way through, and it's very, very good. This is a book about plagues. It's about the history of plagues. It's about the people who have fought plagues in the past. It starts in ancient times and goes forward and deals with stuff like cholera and typhoid and leprosy. The chapter on leprosy is actually really, really interesting. But it's written in a very breezy sort of way. If you like the kind of writing that I do, the kind of writing that Matt does, I think you're going to be a pretty big fan of this book. It's accessible. It's funny in a way that might actually come as a surprise given the subject matter. But it's very engaging and zippy, even, I would say. But I knew it was going to be good and well-researched and funny. I didn't expect it to be quite such a breezy, addictive read, and it really is. It's a lot of fun and informative, and a thing I like, a thing that I really appreciate, is that it's illustrated, but I haven't gotten there yet in my reading, so I don't know if this is commented on in the book itself. Jennifer Wright puts all the like gross pictures of like the diseases and their effects in the back. They are in the back in a section kind of, well, I mean, no pun intended, but quarantined to themselves. And I appreciate that because I want to read about the history. I'm not super into seeing like the physical manifestations of horrible disfiguring diseases. So they're in there if you want them, but they're also like very easy to avoid if you are a little bit squeamish like I am. So definitely head to your local bookstore or your local library and pick that book up. And I'm really interested to keep on with what I guess was her previous book. It ended badly, so that's actually on hold at the library for me, and I am excited about giving it a read. Matt, what is your recommendation this week?
Jennifer writes good stuff. I can verify that. My recommendation this week, I've been waiting a little while to totally wreck it because, it's been a little bit of a slow burn. Two, I know it's not everybody's cup of tea. And three, everybody's already talking about it anyway, or lots and lots of people are. But I thought this would be as good an opportunity as any to talk about the new season of Twin Peaks, which is just past the halfway point and really sent me into a spiral of, as I mentioned a few episodes ago, just kind of offhandedly, really sent me into a spiral of revisiting all of David Lynch's past work, not just the Twin Peaks TV show from the 90s, but also all his movies, all the way back to Eraserhead. Because what you notice about the new Showtime Twin Peaks right off the bat is that it's somewhat a continuation of the Twin Peaks TV show, but it is so much more of almost a career retrospective for David Lynch. There are references to so many of his movies. Like, there are so many moments that are so similar to Eraserhead, similar to Lost Highway, similar to Mulholland Drive, similar to other things from other David Lynch movies and projects. So much of the plot of the show is not from Twin Peaks, the TV show, but from the Twin Peaks movie Fire Walk With Me. It's almost like a project that it seems solely meant to redeem Fire Walk With Me, which was a movie that was not well received when it came out because it's so much darker than Twin Peaks, the TV show. A lot of people have had complaints about the pacing of the new Twin Peaks, and I get that, but I almost see it as satire because what Twin Peaks, the original show, was doing was serving as sort of a satirical yet also concurrently serious look at the big trends of TV of that particular time, which were primetime soap operas, like Dallas and Dynasty and that kind of stuff. And Twin Peaks absolutely and completely served as like a send-up of that kind of TV show. In 2017, it wouldn't be sending up a primetime soap opera because those don't really exist anymore outside of reality shows. So what the new Twin Peaks is sending up and satirizing is prestige television, where a season can be like a month in the characters' lives, right? Like, where only incremental progress is made in an episode before the story continues in the next one. And so, in some ways, I see it as a very clever send-up of, like, big prestige TV, while at the same time kind of being also that. So, if you can't tell, I'm really into it. I'm really digging it. If you somehow have not watched it yet, and I feel like a lot of the people who want to watch the new Twin Peaks are watching it, but you can get, I know you can get a free preview, like 30-day preview of Showtime on Hulu now. There's an add-on on Amazon, and if you get the free preview, you can watch like all, I think there are 10 episodes all, as of right now. I guess 11 by the time this episode goes up. You can watch all those episodes as part of the preview and get very close to the end of the season by the time that happens. And Chris, I think we may have discussed Twin Peaks at one time or another. I don't know if you ever got into like binging streaming it, but I can totally understand why like somebody would not be into it. I just am.
I really like the first season, and I watched it years ago. I had to watch the pilot on a VHS tape because the first DVD set that was available didn't have the pilot, which might be the worst possible move when you're making a Twin Peaks DVD. But yeah, I was a big fan of the first season. I never really got too deep into season two or into the Fire Walk With Me at all. So
I think there are parts of season two you can skip. Although, on a rewatch, the parts of season two that I at one time thought were bad and unwatchable are actually enjoyable if you don't come to it with a particular expectation of certain like mysteries being solved. And you're kind of just enjoying the act of being in this town and being with these characters. But anyway, I am very much enjoying the new series. But everyone's mileage absolutely may vary. All right, Chris, those are our recommendations. Let's talk about some comics.
I love those.
So a few weeks ago, we talked about the first two parts of the War of Jokes and Riddles in Batman. And a lot of times, if we've already talked about something, we don't necessarily keep talking about it with every part of a story. But the third part of the War of Jokes and Riddles really threw us a curveball.
Yeah, because it's the dark, grim, gritty, horrifying origin of Kite Man. Which feels like the punchline that Tom King has been building up for a year. King, famously for me anyway, reintroduced Kite Man with his catchphrase, Kite Man, hell yeah. And I think once that happened, I quickly realized that it wasn't just going to be a thing where it's like, you know, for people like me who are endlessly delighted by Kite Man. And this issue pays it off. I think there's two ways to look at it. You can look at it as a genuine attempt to make Kite Man relevant. You know, like make you feel about Kite Man in a way you never thought you were going to. Do that whole, you know, hate is cold, hell is cold, and I'm Captain Cold kind of thing. That Geoff Johns rogue thing with Kite Man. Or you can look at it as genuinely hilarious. And I don't want to ascribe motivations to Tom King. We should say that the rest of the creative team on this issue was...
The art is by David Gianfelice.
Yes.
taking over from Mikhail Janin, and I actually liked the art in this issue a bunch. It did not have any of the stuff that I thought was weird about the first two parts of The War of Jokes and Riddles. I thought the art in this issue was just good. So take that as you will.
Yeah. Like, I don't want to ascribe motivations to them, but I think we've read enough of their comics that I feel pretty okay in believing that they know what they're doing. Like, they know when Kite Man has a dead son that is killed flying a kite by the Riddler, or by the Joker, and one of the last things that Kite Man did was tell his son not to say hell yeah, so that his hell, Kite Man hell yeah catchphrase is actually, like, the last thing he said to, like, his last thing he told his dead son not to say. They know what they're doing. They know exactly what they're doing. I don't think it's bad, but I think the joke of it is that it is played incredibly straight.
I think
that works. I think it's fun.
I think it can be both. I think it can be a serious, okay, Kite Man's a real player now story, and Tom King can also be aware that it's hilarious.
Yeah.
I don't think those things have to be mutually exclusive. I think they can be both at the same
time. I think you're right. And one of the reasons I think that is because thematically, The War of Jokes and Riddles is about Gotham City going crazy after the arrival of Batman. Like, after the arrival of Batman and the Joker and the Riddler, but, like, the idea that Gotham City isn't normal anymore, and what's normal in Gotham City is going to be this now. So, doing the story where it's like, yep, this is a city where everything is very, very serious, even the stuff that should be silly. So I think it really, really works thematically, while still kind of being a grim and gritty origin for Kite Man. I never would have thought they would have been able to pull it off, but I think it works.
I think it is really weird that this is part three of The War of Jokes and Riddles, when it is so clearly an interlude. It doesn't really push the story of The War of Jokes and Riddles forward at all. It just sort of puts another piece on the board in Kite Man. But even so, I think it's fine to take a minute for a little breathing room for an interlude story like this.
Generally speaking, when it comes to an event story, even like a self-contained event story, I really love seeing, I mean, this is almost on the level of an issue of Astro City. You know, this is like, hey, here's how this is affecting this otherwise normal guy. Oh, guess what? He's Kite Man. His name is Charlie Brown.
Yeah, they really, Tom King really hits that Charlie Brown button hard throughout this.
Very funny.
I think it's my favorite issue of The War of Jokes and Riddles so far, strangely enough. While we're talking about tragedies happening to characters, I gotta talk about Archie number 22. This is the big issue, Chris. This is the big issue with the life-changing moment for one of your Archie favorites.
You mean where somebody dies, right? Like this is the issue where somebody dies? I distinctly remember hearing that someone dies.
Okay. I don't know how this happened. Because people had the very distinct impression that a character was supposed to die in this issue. I don't remember if Mark Waid ever explicitly stated that somebody was supposed to die. But I guarantee you that this issue was written and drawn at least at the same time as that promotion was happening. It was definitely when the solicitation came out, right?
Absolutely.
So either some wires got crossed, or there was some misinterpretation happening, because nobody dies in this. However, and Chris, do you mind if I give it away?
I do not mind, but if you are paying attention to the ongoing soap opera that is Archie Comics, you may want to mash that skip button.
Yeah, skip ahead a few minutes, because I'm going to say what happens, because I can't really talk about the issue without talking about it. So in a previous, in as part of this story, this story arc is all about, or starts with a drag race between Archie and Reggie. And Betty gets involved in it because she wants to stop it. And in the midst of all of that, she is the one who gets into a car accident. That was in the previous issue, number 21. This issue is all about the fallout from her accident. The people reacting to it. There's a lot of flashbacks to, you know, Archie and Betty as kids. And Veronica and Betty meeting for the first time. And how Betty kind of helped Veronica out. And there's stuff even about, like, you know, Betty and different teachers and the principal. By the way, I should note that the art in this issue is by Pete Woods. And boy, oh boy, has Archie done a fantastic job of recruiting artists for this series. Everybody's been so good. And Pete Woods continues that. From Veronica Fish to Fiona Staples, obviously, started it off. Betty is in the hospital after this accident. And what we find out by the end of the issue is that the strong implication is that even though she's not dead, she's paralyzed. Which feels like extremely high drama for an Archie comic.
Mm-hmm.
However, with, like, the death of Archie, which this issue reminds me of a lot, and even, like, afterlife with Archie and that kind of stuff, it feels like what has really been getting Archie attention and goodwill and more buzz, for lack of a better term, is that kind of high drama. I can't fault them for doing this. I'm not sure how much I love the story, but it's right in line with what has made Archie work over the past few years.
On the one hand, I agree with you. And I don't, like, on paper have a problem with the story. On the other hand, I think rebooting Archie as a more, for lack of a better term, realistic story makes this one a dangerous one to tell, because we're all used to superhero stories where things get reset at the end of the day. We, even if the end of the day is, you know, 20 years later, because of superhero story conventions. Like, people come back from the dead because there's Lazarus Pits. People, you know, get magic rings that fix them, or continuity gets rebooted and a person who was in a wheelchair for 20 years is no longer. And there's a level of acceptance to that that we have because it plays with superhero conventions. I think doing that in a continuity that is both more realistic runs the danger of, if this gets reverted, like, if this is a fake out and we don't get this happening to Betty and treated well, I think it's got a lot of potential to not work. And meanwhile, this is the same company that still has to put out Jughead every month, you know? And I'm not saying that they shouldn't do it. I'm not saying that, you know, having a disabled character far more prominent than any other they've had in Riverdale in the past is a bad idea. I'm not saying it's a bad idea for it to happen to Betty. As a guy who thinks about Archie comics and the mechanics of them, I'm a little bit wary of it while still enjoying the story. Like, I think the story's actually been really well told so far. And even as I say this, I recognize that, like, the people at Archie Comics are also people who think a lot about Archie Comics. So, you know, like, benefit of the doubt goes to them on this, I think. You know, I've been a fan of what Mark's been doing on this book pretty consistently since it came back. So I just, you know, I'm a little wary of it.
I see where you're coming from with that. And I don't disagree. I think that's especially true when you consider the recent controversy that has emerged around Jughead's sexuality, where there was this whole thing where, you know, Jughead's asexual, and it feels like that got walked back a little bit, at least on Riverdale, the TV show. So if you're going to make a major character, a representative of a group, where, you know, Betty is now sort of the Riverdale representative of a disabled character, you got to be careful with that. And so
yeah.
I am interested in how they're going to handle it going forward.
Yeah. Or, you know, or Betty gets feeling in her legs back on page 3 of next issue, and it's just comics. There's a lot of ways I can see this going wrong, but hopefully it'll go right.
Well, I think at any other time that would be less of a big deal, but now when you generate in that sort of where there's an instant expectation, presenting that possibility and then walking that back could be have some potential for being a powder keg also. So we'll see how it turns out. I do like the way the story was told in this issue alone, even though it was a little dark and unexpectedly dramatic in ways that I don't always expect from my Archie comics. One last comic that we're going to talk about, Chris, is Lazarus X66 number 1, which is the new mini-series continuation of the Greg Rucka, Michael Lark Lazarus series, even though it's Steve Lieber doing the art on this instead of Michael Lark.
Essentially, it's Steve Lieber doing a fill-in arc, which is mentioned, you know, by Greg Rucka in the back matter, that they wanted to give Lark a chance to kind of recharge his batteries. So it's Lieber stepping in and doing kind of a side story that serves as a sequel to The Cull, which was a really, really interesting part of Lazarus. I love Lazarus. I don't know if we've talked about it a lot on the show because I think I caught up with the first volume in paperback, so it wasn't one of the ones we were reading month to month. But it's one of my favorite versions of a post-apocalyptic future, or a dystopian future. I think post-apocalyptic might be the wrong thing to call it, even though it's certainly things are bad in the future of Lazarus. But the Cull involved, you know, one of the, you know, barely citizens, like the people who do not perform a useful function in the society that are called waste, being elevated to work for the family that rules over them. And that in itself is a pretty interesting premise. But this one follows her as she enters training. And there are few things Greg Rucka is the undisputed master of, as much as he is the undisputed master of a boot camp issue. He did it in Checkmate with the new Mademoiselle Marie, who was really, really great. He's done it, I think, with like Batman training stuff with Sacha Bordeaux. It's a thing he seems to enjoy, kind of coming up with these, you know, superhumanly harsh, like Larry Hama style, this is what training to be an elite soldier is like stories. And they always work, and they always have so much character and so much interest in them. And this is really no exception. Lazarus, legitimately one of my favorite books on the market, and this is, you know, if you're going to follow up on Michael Lark, you can do a lot worse than to pick Steve Lieber, who, you know, one of the all-timers. Definitely, definitely check this one out. And if you have not already caught up on Lazarus, it's one of Greg Rucka's best comics in the last 17, 18 years that he's been writing comics. So jump on it. It's great.
Yeah, it builds a world unlike any other. And this series does an admirable job of depicting like full-on war in a way that the regular series doesn't do so much because it's so focused on like the controlling families. It's a really interesting perspective and while still being part of the same series.
Tying into our last discussion, it actually involves the back matter actually involves a really interesting discussion via letters page of a disabled character who was featured in a previous arc. So if you want to read some smart takes on that stuff, pick this book up. It's a good stuff.
All right, Chris, that's going to do it for our comic review segment of the show. Let's talk to James D'Amato about Dungeon Dome.
Let's do it. Us for the program this week, somebody that we're always glad to have on the show, a good friend of ours, a good dude, a game designer, a podcast host, a improviser, an RPG player, your favorite Star Wars guy. Well, second favorite Star Wars guy, probably.
There are a lot of Star Wars guys, Chris. There are a lot.
I mean, like, you're like my second favorite Star Wars guy.
Okay, I guess that's fair. On the Sims scale, I think I register.
Yeah, it's you, and then, like, just sitting pretty at the top is JPC.
I mean, you forgot to mention Gordy Award winning podcaster.
Gordy Award winner, yeah. Wow. It's the most prestigious award in comics. James D'Amato is here. James, how are you?
Hello, heroes. I'm doing fantastic.
Oh, see, I didn't get to steal your catchphrase from you this time.
No, you didn't preempt me this time.
Lord knows I tried. That's a power move.
That is most certainly a power move. We're cataloging power moves. We were doing it before the podcast started, and I imagine we'll do it long after the podcast ends.
James, what's the best power move you've ever pulled on somebody?
It wasn't something that I pulled on somebody. I'm not typically too good at that thing. But Kat tagged me in a screen cap from an anime about a polar bear who runs a cafe. And there's like an exchange between a polar bear and this grizzly bear where the polar bear is just asking the grizzly bear to do an outrageous number of personal favors. And the grizzly bear is like, I'm not doing this. Who do you think I am? And the polar bear just has like this deadpan look and says, I think you're my friend. And tagging me in that, knowing that Kat has like pulled moves on that like me before, that's a power play right there. And I don't know how to strike back at being tagged as that grizzly bear.
That is certainly a power move. But James, you are here to talk about power moves of a sort, I guess.
Yeah, I guess that is
one of the reasons you're here.
That's absolutely true. I am here to talk about my new project, and it's not really a new project because I have done it before, just not on this scale, and that is the Dungeon Dome. It's a new actual play project. If you are a War Rocket Ajax diehard, you know Chris and Matt are fans of actual play shows like The Adventure Zone, like Campaign. And my project, The Dungeon Dome, combines Dungeons and Dragons with professional wrestling.
This is the thing I wanted to talk about. I'm going to stop you there. That's a power move. Because this is the thing I wanted to talk to you about. To my knowledge, you're not like a wrestling guy. Like, you're not one of the people who won't listen to War Rocket Ajax as soon as we bring up the Sport of Kings. But am I wrong? Did I miss somewhere where you became a wrestle man?
So I am not the biggest wrestle man, and I think like I was a fan as a kid. I watched primarily during the Attitude Era. Like, The Rock was my favorite wrestler growing up. I really loved Mick Foley. And then, like, I sort of just got into a school situation where I didn't have any friends that watched wrestling. And, like, it's sort of hard to keep that going if you're the only one who's into it. It sort of got displaced by, like, anime, which is almost exactly the same thing. So, I grew up, you know, like, having a passing knowledge of wrestling, and you know, then I started listening to War Rocket Ajax, which really brought me back into the Sport of Kings. And hearing you and Matt talk about it gave me a deeper appreciation to the things that I was enjoying as a kid. Like, I think there is a stigma that surrounds wrestling that unfortunately prevents too many people from getting into it. Like, a lot of people that I know that aren't into wrestling think of themselves as nerds. And as nerds, they identify as intellectuals, and they believe that wrestling is not intellectual, which I, you know, even though the WWE does, like, have that sort of anti-intellectual, like, heel casting, I think generally speaking, it is not anti-intellectual as an activity. And it's actually, like, a really neat storytelling form that mirrors a lot of other media that I like.
Well, that's the thing about it, right? It's as intellectual as you want it to be. Like, you can watch wrestling and just take it as it comes, be into the stories and root for the people you want to root for, and believe it as much as you want to believe it. Or you could turn it into this huge intellectual exercise where you're trying to determine what's happening backstage and what the bookers are going to do and fantasy book and
absolutely
and have like that Marky experience. Like you there are different levels to how much you want to intellectualize pro wrestling.
And like that's the thing that like pulled me back in is hearing you guys try to break down those moves by creative, analyze the way different wrestlers were being treated and storyline. And ultimately, like I've watched a couple matches because you guys, you know, just kept talking about wrestling and I did not turn off the episodes when that popped up. So I absorbed that information. And I tried to watch a few matches, and I found that even though I was appreciating it more, like as an art form, as an athletic activity that I was watching, the creative team at WWE, I found, ultimately is not telling the type of stories that I dig the most.
join the club on that one, buddy.
And like, you know, I heard of Shikara and because of you guys, and like a lot of what they're doing sounds like it's my jam, and I still need to dig deeper into Lucha Underground. So I know there are promotions out there that are booking more to my taste, but, you know, ultimately I found myself with this appreciation for a thing that wasn't really taking the form that I wanted. And, you know, the snarky response to everybody that's like, oh, well, if you don't like it, go make your own. So I did. I just took my friends and I'm like, okay, we're going to do this in a context that we can do it. And as pasty improvisers who are out of shape, we're not going to be body slamming each other. But we can describe like elaborate soap opera-esque storylines and really elaborate action scenes like we've done in our podcasts in the past. And we can take what I find interesting about wrestling and we can really explore that space. So that is what the Dungeon Dome is. It's my attempt at, you know, showing off like, this is what I love about this. This is what I appreciate about this. I think that probably, you know, I'm not the best guy to recreate wrestling. Like I think of Sailor Business a bit. Like I'm just the guy with the microphone that like has an idea and we'll see how that pans out. But I think the first couple matches are pretty good.
Well, I want to get into those in a second, but there's another like piece of the James D'Amato wrestling puzzle that I want to get through first.
Yes, yes, let's go down this path.
Well, you, as our listeners know, hopefully, because Matt and I have both been on a couple different times, and Jordan and I have been on as a kind of crossover with Sailor Business, you do the One-Shot podcast, where mm-hmm. you run a one-shot adventure using a variety of game systems. It's a great show that will really, if you're a person who likes role-playing games, it is a dangerous show to listen to, because you'll want everything. Everything sounds so fun. Fucking Dracula dossier episode, man. God, yeah. It was like it's right up my alley. But you recently ran an episode of the Worldwide Wrestling RPG that Nate Paletta wrote. Mm-hmm. And you had Colt Cabana, an actual pro wrestler,
yes,
on your show, role-playing as a pro wrestler in his first ever role-playing game.
Yeah, we did. That was bonkers and like so much fun to do. We managed to get Colt on the show because I did an episode of the Hello from the Magic Tavern podcast, which is another like fun show if you like improv and like fantasy themed comedy. It's like a real Chicago improviser inside baseball thing, but it's a really fun show. I did an episode and Colt did an episode. And one of my fans like remarked, oh man, it was really cool to hear Colt on Magic Tavern. I would love to hear him on One Shot. And then Arnie, who's the host of Magic Tavern, chimed in and was like, actually, Colt, I think you'd really enjoy it. And like, you know, I looked up Colt, you know, I saw that he was a real for real pro wrestler. And there have been, like, because I know there's a guy in my office who, like, does pro wrestling, too. He's just started, and he's gone through a couple, like, training things. But like, Colt, you know, is somebody who is, like, deeply established in the industry. And, like, I couldn't believe that he would even come on the show at all. But I was like, yeah, I'd love to have you on because I know a game designer, Nate Paletta, who's designed a system called Worldwide Wrestling that I have like sort of been holding on to in my back pocket because I really wanted to show it off in its best light. For ages, I was actually trying to get Jill Thompson, the comic book artist, because she is really into wrestling, and I think she would be a lot of fun to have on the show. But like, we would have these conversations in real life where she's like, "Yeah, that sounds great, I'll do it," and then would never respond to an email. So like, I got too precious with it, and then Colt came along, and it was sort of the perfect combination for it.
Here's my smarky Colt Cabana joke. I've never heard of Colt Cabana turning down a booking.
I mean, he is doing my friend Liz Anderson's one-woman no-show in Chicago, like, coming up, which is a very elaborate show where she writes a script for somebody to cold read in front of an audience. Colt agreed to do that, so you're not wrong.
I want to talk about the mechanics of Dungeon Dome. Like how it came into being, because we've talked about Dungeon Dome on the show before when the big Twitch event happened a while back.
Mm-hmm.
What you guys are doing now would be more kind of like a regular series of Dungeon Dome events, right?
Yeah, we're kickstarting a season one, which would be at least 15 matches. It might come out to be more than 15 matches, but it's 15 matches with a handful of side podcasts to sort of fill in the story. And like, if you're a wrestling person, it takes the place of what would be the backstage scenes where you see these people outside the arena as well. But yeah, it would be 15 matches that we're trying to do. So it wouldn't be like ongoing in the sense that campaign is ongoing, where there's like an end that Kat has in mind, but like it's not really in sight for the next couple of years. Dungeon Dome is like a contained event, but we're trying to make it much bigger than it was initially.
So as a what you might call a lapsed wrestling fan who has sort of come back to the fold and has an awareness of the tropes of professional wrestling, and as a very active fan, designer, creator, player, master of games, how did you put together the system for Dungeon Dome?
I'll try to keep it broad strokes because I know this is an audience that's adjacent to role-playing games, but essentially I am mostly using Dungeons & Dragons 5th Edition. The reason I'm doing that is it has a huge audience. When people think of role-playing games, they think of D&D, and I want anybody who might be coming over from the wrestling crowd to at least be on firm standing there. I have a vague notion of what D&D is. You're rolling D20s and you're in a fantasy universe. I think the fantasy universe lends an interesting flavor to a wrestling context because you've got the idea of gladiators that fit in very well with fantasy, and you sort of match it with our modern approach to what combat sports are, which is a little bit different. But the mechanics that we're playing with are actually really experimental, and it's because role-playing games are kind of in a new phase. There are two audiences, or at least Wizards of the Coast, the company that holds the property for Dungeons & Dragons, sees that they now have two audiences. They have D&D's core audience, which are, you know, people who play role-playing games, and they're sort of the people that you picture when you picture a role player, and they have what they call the Twitch audience, and those are the people who listen to actual play podcasts, who will watch shows like Critical Role on Twitch, or will listen to the Adventure Zone or Campaign or something like that, and they are now trying to serve that Twitch audience better. And as a game designer, I'm now in the position where I think within the next year to 3 years, we are going to see a bunch of games come out that are developed specifically to be played to a Twitch audience, where there are mechanics for people who are watching a game, not necessarily playing firsthand, to get involved and have an effect on the story. And I want the Dungeon Dome to be interactive. So I'm taking my first step as a game designer into this realm where I'm thinking, okay, how about instead of running actual play, just putting a mic or a camera in front of a game that would be a very traditional game, let's design a game that could only work through this format. And that's kind of what the Dungeon Dome is, because if I was running this for just me and my friends, as the game master, I would be the only one getting the full story because I'd be running all the matches and not all the players would be present for all the matches. So it can only work if it's being broadcast out to an audience. And I am trying to take advantage of that, trying to add a couple mechanical twists that will allow the people watching the game dramatically change what's happening in it.
Here's the thing I love about that. And I say this, you know, knowing that I am a friend and a fan of yours, James. One of my favorite descriptions of pro wrestling was when someone said that pro wrestling is a LARP.
Yeah, it's a LARP.
Where the wrestlers are pretending to be wrestlers and the audience is pretending to be an audience.
Yes, yes. I mean, that's it, isn't it? It, like, pro wrestling, WWE, is the most successful LARP that has ever been run. And yeah. It's being run continuously.
The big trick of it is that nobody thinks it's real. We just all like pretending that it's real.
Yeah.
In the same way that we like pretending that, you know, every TV show is real.
Exactly.
Like, it's the same way that I like pretending Batman is real.
I mean, but it's a little bit deeper than that, though. It's not like DC Comics is out there going, oh, we've seen the Batman. No, they're like, come watch our Batman movie about this fictional character named Bat W Man.
Well, I described it once as pro wrestling is like comics if the Joker could decide that he didn't want to lose a fight. The Joker didn't like the way he was being booked that month.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, for sure, it's pretty wild. It is pretty buck wild how the whole thing has evolved. And like, if you're one of the non-wrestling fans who's listening, and I dearly hope you are, that is one of the things that appeals to me most about wrestling. I really like the bleeding over of fictional and non-fictional spaces. Like, one of my favorite things ever is that Kermit the Frog is verified on Twitter. It's not the actor who plays Kermit the Frog being verified on Twitter. It's the frog himself. And in that way, we have, like, created an immortal being in Kermit the Frog. Like, he will outlive everybody who ever plays him because a company owns his copyright. It's never going to stop coming. So Kermit the Frog is, like, the one person who's, like, kind of a person who's never going to die. And that's sort of how wrestling works, too.
It's interesting you bring up Kermit the Frog, because the actor...
I was going to say it.
Kermit the Frog's got heat, brother.
Yeah, oh boy, man, it sounds like I would love to see that resolved in a match between him and Henson's kid, because it sounds like they got real beef.
It's interesting that you mentioned the Muppets, because Seamus from the WWE is
a Muppet!
Is canonically Beaker's cousin. That is Muppet canon and WWE canon at the same time.
That is, like, and that's beautiful. That it is beautiful that that took place, and that...
Yeah, how can you not love it? If that is a fact about this thing, how can you not love it? Is where I'm at.
It's, I think it bleeds into that, like, sense of maturity, and, like, I think... There's this, like, weird self-importance that you get when you grow up that, like, you necessarily have to grow out of certain things. And I think that prevents people from a lot of fun. And it's, like, a weird, unnecessary societal shame that we hang on people as they're coming of age.
I literally have never experienced that feeling.
That is your superhero power, Chris. And I'm sorry to tell you that it's not Heat Vision, because Heat Vision seems like a lot of fun, but you get to enjoy Christmas, which that's the real one.
I do like that you briefly turned into James from Team Rocket there.
James D'Amato is dead. James only remains.
Well, I wanted to just tell you, James, that whether this was a conscious assessment on your part or not, you've really pinpointed about the audience participation part of things. Mm-hmm. You've pinpointed the one form of entertainment that exists still today where an audience is an active participant in this, what is ostensibly scripted presentation. Because only in pro wrestling can an audience reaction potentially change the outcome of a match, at least change the length of a match. If a crowd is hot, a match might go longer. If a crowd is sitting on their hands, they might cut it. Like, the only thing that comes to mind that might be similar would be like a concert, like where a band might cut it short or not do an encore or whatever because of the way the audience is acting. But like, you're not going to go to a stage play and have an actor whisper to another actor, "We better cut this, brother. They're cold."
Yeah, so,
but in pro wrestling, there's the real time reaction of like how the wrestlers perform based on how the crowd reacts, and then you know which wrestlers get a push and everything else is based on how the crowd reacts too. So if you were going to plug into that Twitch audience, you have nailed it. You have found it.
And those are the game mechanics that I'm sort of mulling over. Like, and we have an element of that in improv, like, because we're editing scenes and whatnot based on, like, whether or not we think a scene is really popping off. That may or may not have to do with the crowd. That might just do with the personal tastes of everybody else on your team.
I know of improv people who care about the audience and who do not care about the audience. So.
I think both approaches are valid.
Much like the two approaches to hosting the War Rocket Ajax podcast.
But, it's something that I'm really hoping that we can get at with the Dungeon Dome. And if I don't, like, here's the thing about the Dungeon Dome that I know is true. I have some of the best performers in Chicago. And no matter what happens with my mechanics for the game, it is going to be a really fun thing to watch. If I manage to really get a good grip of these mechanics, you're going to see some interesting game designs like come out of the Dungeon Dome. And even if I mess it up, if like I'm totally off base with what I think is going to work for this project, I will have also learned something really interesting about what doesn't work for this format.
I have a question that is actually more on the game side of things. I've talked to you before about how, you know, I love role-playing games. I specifically am a big D&D guy. I've told you before that my heart is not in what is traditionally known as a storytelling game. Mm-hmm. I want magic items. I require magic items. But at the same time, as it, like, in practice, like that's a purely like mental hang up on my part, because in practice I really like the role playing aspect. I really like being a character. I really like conversations and combat in a role playing game is notoriously often the least fun part of it. Like the pure combat of, you know, rolling the dice, rolling initiative, rolling an attack. If it goes on for more than like three rounds, especially I have the 5th edition player's handbook, but I do not have, like, I have not played it yet. So especially in like a 3.5, a Pathfinder, those games I think have robust and enjoyable combat systems. But if the combat goes on even a minute too long, it's boring. And it's not fun. So when you have, you know, I watched the Dungeon Dome stuff because it's on YouTube. If anybody hasn't seen it, there's really fun matches. I was watching it today, and I just want to know how you approach combat, not only running the Dungeon Dome, but also running all the one-shot games where everybody seems to be having fun as a participant in campaign. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you approach combat in a way that stops it from getting boring? Is it just a matter of not just rolling an attack every turn?
Actually, the really best way to put this, a mutual friend of ours, I think, John Rogers, who did The Librarians and Leverage, said something to me about when he was
one of 17 credited writers of the Catwoman movie.
Yes, yes. He's on that list of the big 17, wrote the core, wrote the first Transformers movie, the John Rogers. He talked to me about working with Jackie Chan on Jackie Chan Adventures, and how Jackie explained to him how to, like, run a fight scene. And it sort of brought to life a bunch of ideas that I know Kat and I were juggling for a long time. And it's just like, oh, when Jackie Chan says it, it makes so much sense. In a fight scene, there's what Jackie calls a fight line, which is like the thing that is driving the action. Because you can have a lot of really impressive and interesting looking stunts that are filmed in a cool way. But if it is not flowing through the scene in a naturally narrative way, it can get boring very quickly, or you know, that everything is going to fall flat. And what we're trying to do in the Dungeon Dome, and what I'm doing in One Shot, is I am trying to have the most appropriately dramatic thing happen at any given time. And like, if the players are not perfectly motivated to fight, like, that's the time to stop the fight. Whether you stop it with like a deus ex machina, you know, making continuing to fight impossible, or whether you stop it however you choose to stop it, like, there is a point where if the fight line is not there anymore, then you just got to scrap it and move on somehow.
See, that bringing up JC, mm-hmm, is the way to answer a question on this show. if you can cite our favorite man.
I mean, it is Christmas in July still, so.
Yes. We're celebrating all month long, everybody. Do you know of a system that does a particularly good job of having that built in rather than making it another thing the GM has to keep up with? Like, it's one that I've read a lot of adventures and I've read the core book, but I haven't actually sat down to play it. But I always liked the idea of the 13th age escalation die.
Yeah.
Where everybody just hits harder as the fight goes on to truncate the fights.
13th age is a really good example. You know, if you are somebody who has played Dungeons and Dragons in any edition and found yourself dissatisfied with the combat for one reason or another, 13th age is a really good solution for that, because it is always driving things to reach a more and more dramatic conclusion. I really loved it as a game when we played it with, I think we got Weeb on that one, Curtis Weeb, to do that one with us. It was a lot of fun. 13th Age does a good job of it. I'm glad that you gave me the chance to plug Feng Shui, which we have an episode coming up with you two mid-August for One Shot's 4th anniversary.
And who do we play in that, in this glorious month of Chansmas in July?
I believe you play Jackie Chan, Chris, and uh-huh. I believe Matt plays Jackie Chan's film partner, you know, infamous for being on so many great films with Jackie Chan, Shaquille O'Neal. I am citing a better world.
A better, more beautiful world. Well, James, people can back the Dungeon Dome Kickstarter. Do you have like a shortened URL for that or anything? Or is it just head over to One Shot RPG on Twitter and get a handle on... Yeah. On backing that.
Like, if you, probably the quickest route is to go to @OneShotRPG on Twitter, as I'm tweeting about it like three times a day, every day until the project funds. You can also just go to Kickstarter and search for the Dungeon Dome. We are the only Dungeon Dome on there. You can also head over to the One Shot website. All of the episodes of One Shot that are coming out in the next couple weeks are going to have links to the Dungeon Dome in the show notes.
And we'll link it in our show notes also.
James, have you decided what color your hair is going to be next week?
You know, people really got to pick up the pace. Chris is referencing a challenge that I have issued to my listeners where if they can fund the Dungeon Dome by July 25th, I will dye my hair a color of the collective audience's choice. But you know what? They got to step up their game. Because from my perspective, it looks like this hair is brown, and it's always going to be brown, and you will never control me.
Give them that Ajax bump. That Ajax hair color bump, everybody.
Well, James, it is. I feel like we could talk to you about game design and matches you should watch all night. Maybe that. Maybe we'll have you back for a bonus episode where we do some of that.
I would be open to hearing about matches that I should watch.
It is now the time for our listeners to get the chance to ask you some questions. And Matt, if the people who listen to Warrock and Ajax want to get in on these conversations that we have with our friends each and every week, how exactly can they go about that?
Hit the curtain. Pop the crowd. Get them hot, brother. Get some heat. Take that beat down. Make a comeback. Hit your finisher. Get that 1-2-3. Make them stand up and cheer. Then head on back to the back. Shake your opponent's hand. Say, we'll get them even better next time, brother. Then sign up for an account on twitter.com. And follow the ISB and the Matt D. Wilson. That's Chris and me, respectively. And then after your match, wait until Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 6:30 Pacific. One of us will put out the call for questions, just like the ones you're about to hear for James D'Amato. And then hit that old lonesome trail and go fight in another town.
Beautiful.
Hey, Matt. Before you get into the questions, I want to say, A, I loved that, as I always do. It's one of my favorite parts of the show. B, the word brother came out of your mouth like it was the first time you had ever encountered it.
Brother?
Mike Donahue on Twitter, Barely Sushi, wants to know, who would win in a fight, the Compass Cats or the SWAT Cats?
Man, really good question. I think it depends entirely on the terms of the fight. We're referencing one of the competing teams in the Dungeon Dome, probably the most popular team that we have, the Compass Cats, helmed by Mike Migdahl and Stephen Kropa. They are vampire cats who are elite soldiers in Queen Felicia's army. I think from what I've seen of the Compass Cats performing in the ring, really only Percival the Unwavering is like a good fighter, and Small Benjamin appears to just do whatever he wants and it gets him killed most of the time. But they still have like access to magical powers and like vampire stuff. And the SWAT Cats, like, if it's not aerial combat, I think they're severely hampered in this matchup. So I'm going to give it to the Compass Cats unless it is vehicle-based combat.
Oh boy, the Radical Squadron taking one hard there. Xavier Files on Twitter wants to know, how many sides on a die is too many?
I really think once you start getting above 20, it gets unwieldy. There are D24s that I've seen, D32s, and then there's the D100 that's like a almost completely round object that's full of sand, because if it's not, it'll just keep rolling forever. D20 is good because it actually stops rolling.
You don't like that? You don't like that that D30 that you got to get out of Formula Day?
Yeah, I don't. I don't. And you know what? If they want to make something of it, they can settle it with me in the Dungeon Dome.
That's a good way to answer any challenge.
Mm-hmm.
What if every question that we asked for the rest, the remaining 10 minutes of question time, was you just answered with, yeah, well, why don't you find out in the Dungeon Dome?
That'd be some good promotion. Okay, next up are a couple questions that I'm going to call Kissin' Corner, because the first one comes from The Only Trout on Twitter, John S. Troutman, who wants to know, will Season 1 of Dungeon Dome end in a little kissing or a lot of kissing?
I have one of the things that I thought was missing in wrestling was I want one of my favorite Shakespeare plays to be told out as a wrestling story. It is something that, like, I have always wanted to see, like since I've gotten back into wrestling, and I realized that no wrestling promotion in their right mind would ever give me that. So I'm doing it in the Dungeon Dome. I don't want to reveal the play because I want to let the Shakespeare nerds in the audience like work out what we're doing. But the B plot of the Dungeon Dome is a Shakespeare comedy, so there is kissing involved. It is going to motivate quite a few of the fights that are going to go up in season one if we manage to fund this.
Would you say that there will be as much kissing as you like it?
Swing and a miss, Matt. Swing and a miss.
Sounds like you're really going to be the Tempest.
That is a tragedy.
Joe.
Hell is empty and the devils are here, James.
our pal Joe Hunter on Twitter has the second question in Kissing Corner, who wants to know, which pro wrestler do you think would be the best kisser?
Now, I saw this one as I was retweeting your tweet, Matt, and I've been putting a lot of thought into it. I'm a little stumped. I feel like going with The Rock is like cheating, but I really do think The Rock would be pretty good at it.
Ooh, James, I'm sorry. The correct answer was Kota Ibushi. Kota Ibushi is unquestionably the best kisser of pro wrestling.
Is he the dude who like knocked over that guy in the exchange of kisses and that gift that I see everywhere?
He's wrestling's prettiest kiss boy.
I will. You know what? I'm going to have to concede that question to Chris. Chris is right. I was wrong.
Well, I think you two should settle it in the Dungeon Dome. JJJ Bugle News, J. Jonah Jameson, needs to know, does it need to be Dungeons and Dragons? Isn't that overkill? A very newspaper publisher question.
I can see why he's interested in this subject. You know, a lot of people who have gone on to be antagonists to JJ got their start in wrestling, so he's watching very carefully. You don't need to have Dungeons and Dragons, but if you are not doing it to excess, brother, you're not doing it at all.
Words to live by. Levi P. Tompkins on Twitter is putting you on the spot, James.
Ooh, boy.
He wants to know, on an every one-shot ever character ranking list, who are the top three?
You know, the thing that I am really terrified of is to rank out all the one-shot characters and to just find that JPC has taken literally every spot on that roster, because right away, you know, well, Tris Valentine started as a one-shot character and he's one of my favorites, and I really do love Tommy Euphrates, who is essentially just Tris Valentine again, and
Tommy's Felix, very good.
Felix Cockhammer is also very good. You know, I have to tap out of answering that question because I cannot give JPC's ego too much power.
Fair enough.
I think you should introduce a new segment called Player President, where you rank all the characters that you play in each episode. Just starting now. Starting with maybe the third Feng Shui episode, maybe.
Okay. If we're going to do that, I think our character to beat is we'll just put it because you chose Batman Year One. We'll put Tommy Euphrates as the character to beat. And I think the stinker in that episode, I feel like the Frankenstein character that showed up. That's right. Frankenstein shows up in that episode. Get excited about that. I don't think he did as much as he could have.
Connor Moran has a bit of a puzzle box of a question.
Moran, crack shot.
That's right. Connor wants to know, what's your least favorite color of hair for when you have to dye it? Now, let me open up this puzzle box for you a little bit, James.
Mm-hmm.
If you answer honestly, you could either be forced to dye your hair that color based on tipping your hat, or you could get the sympathy of the listenership and they will avoid that color. You could lie and actually say the color you most want to dye it, expecting that people will want to give you the color that you least want to dye it. Or you could not answer at all and just avoid the whole thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting game theory that's taking place in this question, Matt.
Time for a little game theory.
The honest answer to this question is I haven't thought about it, and I don't have to because y'all aren't pushing hard enough. You will never defeat me. You will never control my hair, and I will show you that in the Dungeon Dome.
I turned into a promo. I like that. Our next question is going to come from CJ Tour. T-U-O-R. I'm not exactly sure how to say that. CJ asks, if close-up magic is the dessert of magic, what is the dessert of pro wrestling?
Ooh, okay. So, man, going by close-up magic logic, it would be whatever wrestling you can do just walking down the street. You know what? I think it's a promo.
A promo is a good option. My answer would be Escapology.
Mm.
Which is what Zack Sabre Jr. does, which is amazing, but very smooth, and he makes it look super easy.
I will have to watch some matches with this.
Yeah.
I'm intrigued.
Find some Zack Sabre Jr. matches to watch.
Matt, may I offer an answer to this question as well?
Certainly.
It's the diamond cutter. There's 52 different variations that can be hit from anywhere.
I feel like that's the cooking an egg of wrestling.
It's my favorite move on the planet.
Stone Cold HCC, who exists only to ask questions.
Oh, yes. Oh, thank goodness. I'm ready.
Has this question. Got any good tips on how to fry up some corn pone?
Damn, Stone Cold. You're asking my Yankee ass how to cook corn pone? You're in the wrong place, friend. But I do think I do have an answer, and that is you head out to Denver, Colorado. You look up my cousin Okoth, who was born and raised in North Carolina, and you say, Okoth, I need some corn pone. James sent me, and I think he'll do you right.
I was also born and raised in North Carolina, and I have no idea how to cook corn pone, but... but I hope your cousin has more knowledge than me.
Okoth was a chef for a while, so I think hopefully retained that skill.
We got several questions from Coltreg on Twitter, but I'm going to only ask this one. And it's for all of us. If you had to enter into gladiatorial combat, what melee weapon would you choose?
This is a good one. Melee weapon, so it cannot be a ranged weapon. Well, okay, so it's not specifying real or fictional, right?
There's no specification of real or fictional.
Well, then I'll pick a lightsaber. Enjoy lightsaber, idiots. You're all dead.
Well, I mean, there's a very big problem with that, in that without the Force, you are very likely to chop your own arm off.
Y'all don't need the Force to use a lightsaber. You can, it's just a... I mean, General Grievous didn't have the use of the Force. He just had a bunch of robot hands.
Do you have robot hands, James?
I don't have robot hands, but if I improperly use a lightsaber, I could probably acquire some.
My answer is easy. I'm a rules lawyer this. Technically, you can hit someone with a gun.
You're not wrong. My answer,
Matt,
is,
how about you?
My answer is a Morningstar. I know I will be instantly killed as soon as I get out there. So I at least want to flail a thing around and look cool for a second.
I mean, yeah, if you're going to go out with style.
Yeah. And that's the number one. I don't even think Morningstars are particularly useful. I just want to flail that thing around. James, I think that's going to be the end of our Twitter questions. Even though we have a few more, I'm sorry about the ones I didn't get to. But before we let you go, James, please let everybody know how they can back Dungeon Dome, even though we talked about that a little bit, and where they can follow you online.
So if you want to back Dungeon Dome, head over to Kickstarter.com, search for the Dungeon Dome. It is $25 to get like the base level of access. It gets you not only... access to high quality video on demand for every match that we put in the Dungeon Dome, but it will give you access to podcast versions of every match. So if you are not so much a streaming and video person, if you're more of a podcast person, we got you covered there too. There are also a bunch of levels that you can back at that will get you more involved in the story. of the Dungeon Dome. So if that appeals to you at all, please don't hesitate to back at a higher level. If you want to get to me, the best place to contact me is on Twitter. I am at OneShotRPG. I am there all day, every day, talking about the stupidest nonsense you can imagine.
James D'Amato has been our guest, one of the best out there. Before we let you go, I do, look, I don't want to tell you how to run your territory, brother, but I would be remiss if I didn't say that so far a lot of the Dungeon Dome is based on tag teams. And I don't know if you need like some outside workers to pop the crowd, but I'm just saying Stone Golem Steve Austin and the actual Rock are probably available.
Well, Chris,
give me a hell yeah.
Chris, we already got plans for you.
That's right. I forgot. You do already have plans for me. That's a nice teaser for everybody. James D'Amato, you are a delight. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you guys so much for having me. Seriously, it was a blast. It's always an honor to record with you guys. And really, I don't know what else I have to say to suck up to you guys to get another Gordy this year. But know that I'm willing to say it.
And the Gordy for best suck up goes to James D'Amato.
Yes.
Thanks once again to James D'Amato. Get out there and back that Kickstarter, because Dungeon Dome is going to be real, real good. If you haven't watched it, check it out on YouTube.
It's time for us to rank some characters. It's time to
elect the best. Panel president time already?
It is. It's time to elect the best and impeach the worst. It's time for panel president. This is our ongoing segment where listeners send in lists of comic book characters and we rank them from the best to the worst. Our list this week comes from Zach, who has some characters for us. He thinks that two of them I won't have much to say about, but at least I can talk about the first three. And the first one is someone I can say a lot about, The Flash, Wally West.
He's kind of the best DC character, so I don't know. He's probably going to do pretty good on this list, Matt.
Our top ranked DC character is Batman.
Yes.
I don't know that he's going to supersede Batman or Superman or Lois Lane or the Joker.
I think he might beat Joker. I really do.
I mean, I'm not totally against the idea of him beating the Joker, because this is where we're really showing, I guess, our generational preference. But Wally West is the best superhero of the 90s, you might say?
Yeah, I think that's the way to... Well, I mean, Adam X, but yeah. Here's what's up about Wally West. Here's the thing, Matt. Wally West is so good that when they brought back Barry Allen, they just had to make him a shittier Wally West.
What's wild is, like, how at the time when the original Silver Age versions of characters were coming back and replacing the legacy versions, the one that seemed to generate the most attention as far as, like, fan outrage was Hal Jordan coming back.
Did that really generate outrage? Because I don't remember people being super mad about that.
I remember there being two very distinct sides of the people who had been wanting Hal Jordan to come back from the beginning. Like the OG Hal Jordan fans and the people who really liked Kyle Rayner.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that I didn't pick up on it when Barry Allen returned as the Flash.
I think by the time it happened with Barry, we were all just kind of resigned to it.
I mean, that's probably true, because the Barry stuff happened after. It hit home a lot more for me when the Flash was Barry instead of Wally.
Yeah. It's when I stopped liking the Flash. And I mean, and again, I say that as someone who has gone back, like, the current Flash stuff I think is actually, like, really good. I'm a big fan of Josh Williamson. There were, like, good Barry Allen Flash stories, for sure, once he came back. But, like, The Flash wasn't my favorite DC book anymore. You know, it wasn't the one I looked forward to the most every month. You know, Matt, and people who listen to the show know, I'm a DC Universe guy at heart. I love Marvel Comics. There's a bunch of non-Marvel, non-DC comics that I love, no doubt. But, like, I love the DC Universe, and I love that 90s post-Zero Hour DC Universe. And the guy that got me there was Wally West via you know, Mark Waid.
Well, if you go listen to the Every Story Ever episodes we've done where we've talked about those 90s Flash stories that we've ranked, and we've ranked a good many of them lately, you can hear our love for those stories and that character in particular. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we need to relitigate that. I think we just need to place him. And I could easily be convinced that he does go above the Joker. Let me tell you who's right below the Joker, though, for a little perspective. Jimmy Olsen, J. Jonah Jameson, Dick Grayson.
Okay, he doesn't beat Dick. He doesn't beat Richard M. Grayson. Or does he? Or does he? Because they kind of go hand in hand.
They do. I mean, there's some truth to that for sure.
The Flash was the best man at Dick's wedding to Starfire that didn't happen.
Well, and so. Wally started as a sidekick.
Yeah. They were Teen Titans together.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to say one more thing about Wally West, and then we'll decide where he goes. One thing that really made me mad when Barry Allen came back, and I think it was a Geoff Johns quote, you know, not to bag on Geoff Johns, you know, but I think he had a quote where he talked about how Barry Allen was a police scientist, and that wasn't something people really got in his original run, but like in the 2000s with police procedurals and CSI being like literally the most popular thing in the world, like it was an opportunity to bring back Barry in a way that like wider audiences would have a better handle on. He's not wrong, but here's the stupid thing about that. Wally West was a full-time superhero, and people who like superheroes know what superheroes are. I honestly think, Wally West goes above Dick Grayson. I really do. And I think he goes between Joker and Lois Lane, because Dick did not define what it is to be Batman. He defined what it was to be Robin. Wally defined what it was to be Kid Flash, and then defined what it was to be The Flash.
The Flash, Wally West, enters the list at number 8. What a showing.
He's very good.
Next up on Zach's list is Green Arrow, Oliver Queen.
Not going to do as good.
No, not going to do as good. I like Ollie. I particularly like the way he's portrayed in Green Arrow comics now.
Yes, the current run's really, really good.
I think that's going to bring him up a bunch of spots, because that Oliver Queen is great. But I think that Oliver is a character that it was very, very hard for anybody to get a handle on for decades.
Well, for, you know, the first 30 years that he existed, he was just a worse Batman.
Yeah, he was a Batman ripoff for a long, long time. And then somebody got the idea of him being what he is in the comics now, in a very real way, someone who fights for the little guy, the rich guy who fights for the little guy, a comics Robin Hood, which is really clever, but was also something that was built into his character very inconsistently. Like, it's not something that was in New 52 Oliver Queen at all. So,
because they wanted him to be young, hot Oliver Queen.
Well, they wanted him to be TV Ollie, right?
Yeah.
And TV Ollie isn't really that. For what's good about Oliver Queen, he is not a character who has been consistently characterized over the years.
Yeah, and the thing that makes the current like DC Rebirth version work so well, aside from like, you know, really great art, really imaginative stuff, in terms of like what he's fighting. I love that issue where the Clock King is selling kids extra time. Like, I think that's fucking brilliant. But he's the first version of Green Arrow who has been built from the ground up as social justice Robin Hood, you know, which is what he should be, because that's the thing that came to define him.
That's the thing that makes Ranieri different.
Yeah, it's the thing that makes him not Batman.
He's worse than Wally. He's better than
Barry.
Oh,
by far. He's better than Barry. Yeah, like that's going to be the new... That's a wide floor and a wide ceiling, Matt.
I know, but those are the two things I know for sure. Worse than Wally, better than Barry.
Yeah. Barry's sitting at 105 right now. Wally's sitting at 8. So that's almost 100 spaces to figure out where this guy goes. I think he's probably going to skew because of inconsistency in character. Because he's a character that, like, Jack Kirby could not make exceptionally interesting. I would say he's not as good as Michelangelo or Ninjak, you know, who we have in the 80s.
Right below Michelangelo, we have Damian Wayne. And right below that is Caitlin Fairchild.
I mean, I think he goes in there.
Yeah, I do too.
I think he probably goes above Damian. And I like Damian, but I like Ollie too.
Yeah, I could see the argument from going above Damian. I think that's where he goes, between Michelangelo and Damian Wayne.
Green Arrow, Oliver Queen, enters the list at number 82.
Next on the list is Hawkeye, Clint Barton.
You want to talk about... I was going to ask which Hawkeye. Well, you want to talk about inconsistent character.
Yeah. But the thing is, I generally like almost every version of Clint Barton, whether he's the, like, loose cannon on the Avengers who's disagreeing with Captain America, or he's the Matt Fraction, like, dude who is just trying to help out his neighborhood, Hawkeye.
I think this is going to be one of those times where it shows that I was never an Avengers guy growing up, because I got nothing for Hawkeye until the Fraction and David Aja. Like, I got nothing for him. We currently have Kate Bishop at number 52, and I don't think there is a way in hell that Clint Barton goes above her.
I mean, I think that's fair because of the inconsistency argument. I have a weird affinity for Hawkeye, in the very least during the music run of Avengers.
I mean, Hawkeye seems like a character I should really like. Like, he's a circus guy, and you know how I like circus guys, Matt.
He's the iconoclast. His character on the Avengers is the one who breaks ranks.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, he's the reform criminal. He rides around on a robot horse, a flying robot horse. He's friends with a cowboy. It's all good stuff, but it, like, doesn't, like, hit. Like, nothing hit until the idea of he's an Avenger and then he goes home. You know? Like he's an Avenger and then he goes home and he's like, yeah, I got a robot horse, but, like, I really want to watch Netflix tonight because I'm sore from being an Avenger.
Here's what I'll say. I can agree with putting him below Kate Bishop, but I think he should go just below. I feel like Clint and Kate are equally good in the Fraction series.
Here's the problem with that, Matt. If that's going to happen, then I need to look you in the eye and tell you that I think Clint Barton is better than Beryl Hutchinson. And you need to look me in the eye and tell me that you think Clint Barton is better than Kim Pine.
I mean, those are both fair. Assessments.
I mean, I would put him, like, I don't think he goes too far below Kate, but I would say, like, maybe we can put him in the Cyclops, Gladiator, Plastic Man area.
I think put him above Slim. Put him above Slim.
Okay, so between Kim and Slim is the Hawkeye.
Okay, next up are two characters that I can't say anything much about. So, Chris, just rank them. First up is Swerve from Transformers More Than Meets the Eye.
Oh, Matt, you're going to love Swerve. Swerve's the one who says that people don't like him. They just laugh at his jokes, and there's a difference. And that shit cut me to the quick.
Yeah, that's me in high school.
Yeah. Swerve is the most relatable Autobot. And he's the kind of – he's the class clown. And he's the loudmouth. He's the guy who accidentally shoots his own... He literally shoots his mouth off at one point. He's the guy who gets the My First Blaster. You know, he's got all the... He's got all, like, the kind of comedy moments that you would expect from the kind of fast-talking guy who's not super good at fighting. But then he... When he opens up and he's like, yeah, like, nobody really likes me. They just laugh when I tell a joke. Like, that's... Fuck. Like, that got me. I love Swerve. Swerve might be my favorite Transformer, actually. I'm trying to think if there's somebody I like better. I like Hot Rod Rodimus a lot. I like Tailgate, obviously. I'm a Tailgate guy. But yeah, Swerve gets it.
So above Megatron.
Yeah, Megatron's pretty low on the list at 157. I would say Swerve, and again, this is based purely on More Than Meets the Eye. I would say Swerve goes at least above Garfield. Probably I would put him a little bit higher. I think he goes above Barry Allen for sure. I don't know if he goes above Volstagg, but I think they're very weirdly similar characters. I would say maybe between the Atom and Nick Fury Jr.
Okay. That works for me.
Number 102 on the list?
The last one here on Zach's list is Whirl from Transformers More Than Meets the Eye.
Ooh, Whirl's a piece of shit. Like, I mean, he's a good character. He's like a real asshole. He was the watchmaker who got his head and hands cut off and then became a crooked cop and accidentally created Megatron. Whirl's interesting, but I don't like him, and I don't relate to him like I relate to Swerve. But I think he's, you know, all those characters are so goddamn well written. I cannot say enough good things about More Than Meets the Eye and Lost Light as comics. But I think I'm not putting Whirl above Garfield. I think Whirl goes down at like a Linda Danvers level, or between Dormammu and Mephisto. That's where I would drop him.
Okay. And that's where he shall go. And that's going to do it for this panel president segment. If you would like to send us a panel president list, you can do so by sending us an email at warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. You can also get in touch with us on Tumblr. If you have a listener question or you otherwise want to comment somehow, you can go to warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. Check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That is where you can stream the show, download the show, read show notes, and leave comments, and see the Every Story Ever in Panel President lists, which I always say this, but I haven't updated it in a while. I will soon, I promise. I think I have maybe a free weekend coming up, free-ish weekend, where I can actually do that. So keep your fingers crossed. If you would like to review the show on Apple Podcasts, we would enjoy that as well. The more good reviews we get there, the more we are featured. So go do that if you can. Now we've reached a part of the show where we tell you where you can find us online. For me, all you have to do is go to mattdwilson.net, and you can find links to all my stuff. Chris, where can people find your stuff?
People can find my stuff by going to the-isb.com or hitting me up on Twitter at @theisb, or going to your local comic book store and picking up stuff like Deadpool Bad Blood, Sword Quest, or Army of Darkness. If you would grab those last two, that would be super sweet, because we would like to do some more of those. Hey, Matt, do you think it would be a good idea if I did like a regular weekly column where like I answered people's questions about comics and pop culture? Like, does that seem like a good idea?
I mean, I don't know if I want to deal in hypotheticals, but I mean, I don't think it's a bad idea.
I'm saying like something where people could like ask me, Chris, like questions that they had about things and they wanted to read about. I think that's probably a pretty good idea.
I mean, again, it's purely hypothetical. It's never been tested. So
never been done before.
Yeah.
Well, it's never been done before, but that's just because we ain't never not done it before, Matt. But now, a column like that is back, or here, I should say, online. It's called That's What's Up, which we got the title that I got from our good friend Ben Gully, who was misremembering the name of a video series I used to do, and it turned out I liked it a lot. So the first installment of that is up on Looper. I'm sure I tweeted it out on Friday. So if you've been wanting a column where you ask me certain things, then this is one that you should absolutely check out, because we're going to be doing it weekly, and it should be pretty fun. And I can maybe get beyond some like comic stuff and maybe into some other things that I have strong opinions about. So we'll see. Go read it. That would be great of you to reward somebody for taking a chance on an untested idea with me doing that. That's going to be it for War Rocket Ajax number 362. We are going to be back next week with another great episode. Matt, how did we do in this one?
HQC. It was HQC, and it was S-Rank, and it was great. I'm not going to make some funny bit out of it, you know. I'm just going to tell you straight up, it was HQC. We love you.
Yeah! It's for every one of us. It's not for every one of us. It's not every body, every man, every woman, every child, every body, flash. We're everything to Flash.
All right, James, I think that's going to be the end of our Twitter questions. I think that's
the arrival of Harrison the Cat heralds the end of Twitter questions.